Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from our Hideaway studio in East County. Today we have some extremely important updates on and major new developments for you on that fast-burning border fire searing its way across East County. We also have news about some new fire patrol vehicles for our region. Next up, we'll have a special report on grand jury findings regarding homeless in East County. We'll tell you about a new cholera vaccine that's been approved for travelers. And then from Public News Service, we'll have the latest breaking headlines from across the nation and the world. We'll tell you about a possible smoking ban at beaches in California. The second half of our show will have some East County favorites on our bookshelf segment. Hear our interview with Timothy Daniels, the author of An Ongoing Investigation. And after that, we'll be taking you on the road to Julian, a historic gold rush town nestled in the mountains of East County. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ with an update on that fast-moving brush fire scorching our region. The border fire started Sunday near Highways 94 and 188 in the East County community of Potrero. It has burned over 1,900 acres and is still just 5% contained as of Monday afternoon. The entire town of Potrero remains under a mandatory evacuation order, and Highway 94 is still closed through the area. New evacuations have also just been ordered for Forest Gate, Star Ranch, Cowboy Ranch, Dog Patch, and Canyon City, CAL FIRE reports. CAL FIRE is warning of extreme fire behavior in the area. So this is a very dangerous fire at this point. All schools were also closed Monday in the Mountain Empire School District due to the fire. The National Weather Service has issued a red flag alert due to extreme fire conditions from high heat and low humidity. Three people have been injured in the border fire, including a firefighter, per CAL FIRE. East County Magazine reporter Leon Thompson was at the scene Sunday afternoon, shortly after the fire began. Though CAL FIRE initially reported making good progress on the blaze when it was only 3 or 4 acres, Thompson told us that when the winds kicked up, the fire suddenly exploded, growing to 1,500 acres in a matter of hours, and now, today, 1,900 acres. Hundreds of firefighters from across Southern California are battling the blaze in steep, rugged terrain that has not burned in many years and is dry from years of drought during triple-digit heat. An emergency shelter has been opened by the Red Cross at the Campo Elementary School, located at 1654 Buckman Springs Road in Campo. 10 News reported yesterday that 44 people spent the night at an overnight shelter at Campo Elementary School, some of them forced to sleep in their cars along with pets, on a day when temperatures had reached 110 degrees in the area. CAL FIRE earlier announced a shelter at the Campo Community Center, but since it's not an official Red Cross center, a note on the door at one point referred people to the Campo Elementary School an hour away, according to 10 News. Reporting San Diego's Nadine Abbott was also at the scene. She indicated that some horses were turned loose by County Animal Services personnel to save the animals from the fast-moving fire. Nancy Fritz in Potrero said her home was saved thanks to water drops from a very large air tanker, or VLAT. Other aircraft, including helicopters, also dropped water on the fire. Some people defied evacuation orders and stayed behind. One neighbor from a nearby community, wearing shorts and flip-flops, fought a fire with a garden hose to help save other people's homes, an action that, while courageous, is also very dangerous. CAL FIRE urges everyone in the impacted area to please leave. Several outbuildings have burned, and there is an unconfirmed report of a possible home lost. Flames came within 50 feet of the town's general store, a historic structure that dates to the 1800s. SDG&E's website indicates 94 customers without power in Dulzura Potrero Campo, the fire area, with power restoration expected at 6 p.m. Monday. A separate unplanned outage in Lake Morena has left about 96 without power, and restoration there is also forecast for 6 p.m. Phone landlines and cell service are also both out in the Potrero area, leaving some residents virtually without any communication at all. SDG&E has issued a flex alert for today and is asking all customers to conserve power. Outages are possible, so please be prepared. Additional flex alerts may occur later this week since the extreme record-breaking heat is forecast to continue. Multiple high heat records for yesterday's date were shattered across San Diego County, with temperatures soaring as high as 118 degrees in desert communities and well over 100 in many inland towns. If you need emergency assistance or help with evacuation, you can call 911. If you need additional information, check the San Diego County Emergency website at sdcountyemergency.com or call the San Diego Sheriff's Department's non-emergency line at 858-565-5200. You can also dial 211. If you need help with large animal evacuations due to the fire, you can call the San Diego County Animal Services Department at 619-236-2341. You can also get information on this and other emergencies by following our East County Alert on Twitter or signing up for our free East County Wildfire and Emergency Alerts at eastcountymagazine.org. For more news on the border fire, you can also check out the hashtag BorderFire on Twitter.
San Diego County Fire can now dispatch up to 4 new quick-attack vehicles to assist CAL FIRE when a brush fire breaks out in a hard-to-reach part of the backcountry. The vehicles, known as patrols, are smaller and faster than the larger engine, but are equipped with all the same basic life-saving equipment. They can hold up to 200 gallons of water and 10 gallons of gel or foam. The new fire patrol vehicles are assigned to county fire stations in Hakumba, Palomar Mountain, Duluth, and Shelter Valley. Many of these areas were burned during the destructive 2003 and 2007 wildfires. While the vehicles were generally built for wildfire response, they will also be used to respond to everyday calls for medical aid, traffic collisions, and structural fires. Patrol vehicles will be frontline, first-roll response units at volunteer or reserve stations and will supplement the current county fire fleet. CAL FIRE and County Fire Chief Tony Meacham says that for the rural backcountry, the patrol vehicles are more suitable than a fire engine. They are simple to operate, very quick and maneuverable, and allow our reserves to get to the scene quickly, he says. They are also used for mop-up, allowing fully staffed engines to be put back into service quickly. This type of patrol vehicle is new to County Fire's fleet. 5 were purchased last year and were used heavily, particularly when County Fire and CAL FIRE were assisting other counties as part of a mutual aid strike team. The patrols have 2 people on them at a time, and firefighters are required to take additional training on the operation of these vehicles. Each patrol, fully equipped, costs nearly $260,000. 2 of the new vehicles were funded by federal community development block grants for low and moderate income areas, and 2 were paid for by the county's general fund. County Housing and Community Development Director Todd Henderson concludes, "Strengthening our regional fire defense is a critical component of healthy, safe, and thriving communities, and one the county can be proud to stand behind." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
This is Miriam Raftery with a special report on homeless issues in East County. The San Diego County Grand Jury has issued a report critical of 4 cities in East County for failing to provide adequately for the needs of homeless people, including failing to apply for federal funds available for that purpose. The Grand Jury report, titled "East County Cities' Lack of Response to Homelessness," looked at El Cajon, La Mesa, Lemon Grove, and Santee, also offering recommendations for improvements. Grand Jury Foreman Melinda Richards told East County Magazine that most of these cities were doing almost nothing. El Cajon did contribute about $100,000 to the East County Transitional Living Center, she notes, but adds, by and large, not much else. There are some things for domestic violence and families, but for a single homeless person, there is very little. The grand jury also looked at funding available. Richards states, "It seemed to us that cities in East County weren't getting any because they weren't proactive in seeking the funds. About $15 million did come into the San Diego area for homeless issues from the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. San Diego County guidelines state that services should be located proportional to need, but the cities have to ask for their fair share of the money. The grand jury recommends that East County cities initiate common programs to address homelessness by joining the Regional Continuum of Care Council and devoting attention and resources to this underserved group." Now, this report follows up on a 2010 grand jury report on homeless issues in the city of San Diego, which has about 65% of the homeless people countywide. Neither grand jury report addressed the county's handling of the homeless, so the unincorporated areas of East County, such as Spring Valley, Lakeside, Alpine, and Ramona, are not covered by the grand jury findings. And yet, the Regional Task Force on the Homeless, in its 2016 Point of Time Homeless Count this January, found that in the county's unincorporated areas, there were 336 homeless people, and none of them were in shelters, since the county does not operate any places for the homeless to sleep in the entire vast unincorporated region, which includes mountains, deserts, and rural areas. The highest count was in Spring Valley with 134 homeless people. Ramona, an area with cold winter temperatures, had 61 homeless during the January count, while Lakeside had 87 and Casa de Oro had 20. The new grand jury report relied on the 2015 count when it looked at the four East County cities. El Cajon had 721 homeless, including 520 sheltered and 191 unsheltered. The other three cities' homeless people were all living without any shelter at all. Santee had 30 unsheltered homeless people, La Mesa 19, and Lemon Grove 11. And that situation has only gotten worse in the 2016 count, which found a 19% increase in unsheltered homeless people countywide. Now, among East County's incorporated cities, the 2016 count found Santee had 44 homeless, La Mesa 31, and Lemon Grove 12, all still unsheltered. El Cajon had 321 total homeless who were counted, of whom 103 were unsheltered. But Dolores Diaz, executive director of the Regional Task Force on the Homeless, believes the number of sheltered homeless in El Cajon was substantially undercounted this year because the shelter did not keep data required by HUD. The shelter and the city have blamed lack of funding in what seems to be a circle of finger-pointing. El Cajon did allocate about $75,000 of community development block grant funding for the 2016-2017 fiscal year. That covers lodging mainly from October through March for about 8 rooms a night. The bulk of that is for the East County Transitional Living Center's one-year Christian discipleship programs, serving 402 individuals and about 54 families. But for non-Christian homeless people, the options are much more limited. Other shelter programs that help limited numbers of homeless people in East County include the Center for Community Solutions Project Safe House and Next Step Ease, which serves only domestic violence clients. Crisis House serves the disabled and families with children, as well as domestic violence victims. A transitional living program, as we've mentioned, serves about 73 families last year. There's also Home Start, a hotel-motel voucher program for families with children. The Interfaith Shelter Network East County, which served 12 people a week for about 6 months, and Volunteers of America, helping those with disabilities, mentally ill people, and veterans. Homelessness adds substantially to law enforcement costs, the grand jury investigation found. El Cajon police estimate that arrests and calls about homeless people cost $411,000 in 2014. La Mesa police estimate its homeless-related costs for the same year at $269,000. The sheriff estimates that about 10% of all of its calls for services in Santee relate to homeless people. The sheriff and County Department of Health and Human Services did launch the East Regional Homeless Outreach Team in fall of 2015, based out of the sheriff's station in Santee. The grand jury study doesn't mention firefighting costs, but in some unincorporated areas, several small brush fires have originated at homeless camps. There are also costs for sweeps by law enforcement to evict homeless people in areas such as the Sweetwater and San Diego riverbeds. The grand jury also found that the Regional Continuum of Care Council has no East County municipal members. The grand jury report recommends each city join the council to participate in its work to help the homeless. It also recommends that the mayors and city councils of each of the four cities initiate coordinated homelessness-related efforts to increase prevention, shelter, and transitional housing services in East County. California's Penal Code requires each of these cities to respond to the presiding judges of the Superior Court. The deadline for East County's four cities to respond to the grand jury's homeless report is August 29th. Now, we asked for comments from all four of East County's mayors, as well as the vice mayors out in El Cajon, La Mesa, Lemon Grove, and Santee. So far, just one mayor and vice mayor have responded. Lemon Grove Mayor Mary Sessom stated in an email, "We have just received the report and will be reviewing it thoroughly and give its recommendations careful consideration. While we believe the information in the report is not complete, partly as the only elected official consulted was Mayor Wells of El Cajon, we appreciate the look into the issues of homelessness in East County. Homelessness is a serious matter and requires a careful, coordinated regional strategy," Lemon Grove's mayor concluded. La Mesa's vice mayor, Bill Baber, wrote, "I believe our staff is working on a formal response to the grand jury report, but let me speak individually as a council member and only one of five votes on the La Mesa Council. Homelessness is a regional problem, and we need regional solutions," he said. "And I support La Mesa joining the Regional Continuum of Care Council as a municipal member," Councilman Baber added. Colin Parent with La Mesa Conversations, a citizens group planning an upcoming public forum on homeless issues in La Mesa, had this to say upon learning of the grand jury findings. "I participated as a volunteer in the annual homeless count this year in La Mesa," Parent says. "It's disappointing that La Mesa is not contributing resources to prevent our small but real homeless situation." The citizen activist concludes, "We should be spending at least as much preventing homelessness as we spend waiting until problems result in arrests and service calls."
This is Leon Thompson with the Health Report. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved Vaxchora, a vaccine for the prevention of cholera caused by serogroup 01 in adults 18 through 64 years of age traveling to cholera-infected areas. Vaxchora is the only FDA-approved vaccine for the prevention of cholera. Vaxchora is a live, weakened vaccine that is taken as a single oral liquid dose of approximately 3 fluid ounces at least 10 days before travel to a cholera-affected area. Vaxchora is manufactured by PaxVax Bermuda Limited, located in Bermuda. Cholera, a bacterial disease, is acquired by consuming contaminated water or food. It can cause severe diarrhea that is potentially life-threatening if treatment with antibiotics and fluid replacement is not initiated promptly. According to the World Health Organization, serogroup 01 is the predominant cause of cholera globally. While cholera is rare in the U.S., travelers to part of the world with inadequate water and sewage treatment and poor sanitation are at risk for infection. Up until now, travelers to cholera-infected areas have had to rely on preventative strategies recommended by the CDC to protect themselves against cholera, including safe food and water practices and frequent hand washing. Double-blind, placebo-controlled tests of Vaxchora on adults, volunteers in the U.S. and Australia found the vaccine to be effective in 80 to 93% of those who received the vaccine and who were exposed to cholera. The most common adverse reactions reported were tiredness, headache, abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, lack of appetite, and diarrhea. The FDA granted the Vaxchora application fast-track designation and priority review status to expedite development and a review of medical products that addresses a serious or life-threatening condition.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, June 20th, 2016. I'm Mary Sherman. We're highlighting issues from around the nation, including incarceration and the impact on crime rates, a look at the positive contributions of those seeking safe haven on World Refugee Day, and data transparency questioned in the wake of new abortion regulations in Texas. Leading our news, states that reduce their prison populations are seeing their crime rates go down too. Andrea Sears explains in this report.
In the 1990s, getting tough on crime led to a rapid rise in the number of people incarcerated. Now, with more than 2 million people behind bars, the United States has the largest prison population in the world. But according to James Cullen with the Brennan Center for Justice, a new state-by-state analysis of data from 2006 to 2014 shows reversing that trend doesn't increase crime.
Not only is it possible for states to lower incarceration and crime, but actually most states are already doing it. And that's important because it really shows us a pathway forward to solving mass incarceration.
27 states have reduced both incarceration and crime rates, including New York, where the prison population declined by 18% and crime fell by 17%.
The issue of refugees has caused a political divide over the past year, and a new report examines how well refugees from four key groups are integrating into American society. Mike Clifford has the story.
David Disregard-Kallick is with the Fiscal Policy Institute, which released the new report along with the Center for American Progress. Kallick says about 1 in 12 immigrants arriving in the U.S. comes here as a refugee.
Sure, they need some help to get started when they first come to the United States. They've come from some of the most horrific situations around the world. But that when you look at the long term, people become integrated, they start to get jobs, they own their own homes, they learn English, you know, they become Americans.
The report is based on an analysis of the 2014 American Community Survey five-year data and looks at the progress of Bosnian, Burmese, Hmong, and Somali refugees. Kallek says those groups make up about 500,000 of the 3 million refugees currently granted asylum and living in the U.S.
Today is World Refugee Day, an opportunity to welcome refugees and celebrate their resiliency. Blazing heat killed at least 3 people this weekend in Arizona and stoked at least 5 major wildfires across the desert southwest. Excessive heat warnings were issued across Southern California and Arizona, where temperatures soared into the triple digits on Sunday and are expected to remain through today. Meanwhile, with recent temperatures in the upper 80s and low 90s, areas of Iowa that are considered abnormally dry are nearly doubled this month.
At the beginning of June, about 14% of the state of Iowa was experiencing abnormal dryness. Dr. Deborah Bathke, a climatologist with the National Drought Mitigation Center, says drought conditions haven't been reached yet, but they could be.
The abnormally dry means that conditions are there. We really need to start keeping an eye on things.
The National Drought Mitigation Center says while abnormal dryness is the lowest ranking on its drought scale, concerns over a sudden drought also are high. Bob Kessler reporting.
More details about the shooting rampage that killed 49 people in Orlando are expected today. Officials say they will release transcripts of phone calls placed to emergency 911 dispatchers by the gunman who targeted the gay nightclub over a week ago. Omar Mateen, who died in the gunfight with police at the end of the attack, is said by authorities to have repeatedly paused during his 3-hour siege to call 911 and post internet messages from inside the nightclub, professing his support for Islamist militant groups. A story out of the Lone Star State, where the American Civil Liberties Union of Texas claims that health officials are deliberately withholding abortion statistics from 2014, the first year new restrictive regulations were in effect.
The ACLU says for the past 2 decades, the Department of State Health Services has released that data in March, but alleges this year the agency is hiding the information. Attorney Tricia Trigilio with the ACLU says the state has ignored requests under the Texas Public Information Act from the media, academic institutions, and the ACLU.
Under instructions from General Counsel for the Chief Operating Officer, they began responding by saying that the statistics were still being processed and that they weren't ready. That's actually false. The statistics were complete in March.
She says the 2014 abortion statistics are important because they reflect the first full year that House Bill 2's abortion regulations were in effect. State officials released a statement last week saying the data set is not available, and if it were complete, they would release it. I'm Mark Richardson.
As Minnesota's largest energy supplier seeks another rate increase, one group says the move may be too expensive for some customers.
The Minnesota Public Utility Commission is now considering the 6th rate hike request from Xcel Energy in 10 years. AARP Minnesota says for some Xcel customers, it would mean paying about an extra $130 a year. State AARP Director Will Phillips says if the extra charges are approved, those customers will be paying more than what's necessary for their utility service.
Well, it means different things to different people. Certainly for people on fixed incomes who have seen very little in the way of cost of living adjustments for Social Security, it may mean more. Regardless of who you are, how much money you make, only paying what is fair and reasonable is what we need to ensure happens.
The public comment period's open for Minnesotans to weigh in on the issue. Xcel argues the rate increase is needed to pay for upgrades to the power grid and to make investments in cleaner energy production. I'm Brandon Campbell reporting.
I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
Smoking or vaping at state beaches and parks, or disposing of tobacco products at these locations may soon be illegal under Senate Bill 1333, a measure authored by Senator Marty Block, a San Diego Democrat. The measure is passed the state Senate by a 25-11 bipartisan vote this week and next heads to the Assembly. Senator Block says, "We have an obligation to value and preserve our environmental treasures. SB 1333 will help to keep our state parks and beaches clean and safe by removing exposure to secondhand smoke and in reducing the threat of park fires." He added that cigarette litter poses a detrimental effect on the environment and wildlife. Cigarettes are non-biodegradable and contain more than 164 toxic chemicals, which create a substantial trash and health issue at beaches and parks. The senator noted, adding, they can be ingested by wildlife and fish, which leads to the contamination of our oceans and waterways. SB 1333 would make it an infraction to dispose used cigarettes or tobacco waste in parks or waterways and impose a maximum fine of $250 for a violation of the law. The bill also requires the Department of Parks and Recreation to post signs notifying the park and beachgoers of the smoking ban. Block's bill is supported by the California State Firefighters Association, the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, the American Lung Association in California, the Association of California Healthcare Districts, Sierra Club Sacramento, the Surf Rider Foundation, and others. No arguments in opposition were submitted. According to the Legislative Analyst Report, reporting for the East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chisato Iverson.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Timothy Daniels, retired supervisory special agent of U.S. Customs, or ICE, and author of the new novel, An Ongoing Investigation. My guest, who has a long history of working with narcotic smuggling cases and money laundering, he brings a unique perspective to a border city like San Diego. An Ongoing Investigation is the sequel to his debut novel, A Target-Rich Environment, which was published in 2011. Welcome, Tim. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
And thank you for having me, Raina.
Let's begin with An Ongoing Investigation. I know the story is about a task force trying to stem the flow of narcotics coming into the U.S. from Mexico. Tell us a little bit more about what happens in the book.
Well, first, I would just like to say that I don't think most people that live in this area have any kind of clear understanding of how much narcotics come across the border just on a constant basis.
Right.
And it's thousands of pounds probably a day.
Really?
So as I neared the end of my career, I decided that I would like to try to write a book and, you know, kind of paint a picture of what it was like to work in the war on drugs, which unfortunately we're losing. But, you know, there's just a lot of stories that I accumulated over the course of my career, and I wanted people to understand, number one, the amount of drugs coming across, and then what it was like to be involved in the war on drugs, and, you know, tell some of those stories, explain how difficult it is on family life, and, you know, what it requires of somebody. So in my two books, I basically took a fictitious character, Jimmy Maxwell, and I put him in a fictional case that runs 4 or 5 months. But during the middle of that case, it's interspersed with a lot of little sub-stories of cases that I worked on, you know, where I changed some of the names and details to cover that up. But for the most part, the little sub-stories are true. The overarching story, not so much.
So you got a chance to both tell the small stories of what really goes on and give a message about this is what's happening in San Diego.
Yes. And in the first novel, I went into some of the politics involved, which were very frustrating to most of us that were involved in this kind of work. Not so much in an ongoing investigation. I basically made that more focused on Jimmy and his personal relationships and, you know, what it was like to be the target of somebody who was out there trying to get him.
Now, for how many years did you do this work?
About 23.
A wealth of experience.
Yes.
And you're retired now.
I retired at the end of 2009.
Okay. So your protagonist, Jimmy Maxwell, is he you or is he a combination of several people, made up?
He's partially me. I mean, I would like to say that I had his work ethic. And I certainly was as busy as he is in the book during the course of my career. I went through some of those same personal struggles that he goes through. But on the other hand, several of my agents that I used to work with have told me that I'm actually more Tom, his supervisor, the grumpy old guy who, you know, is having to approve everybody's reports and, you know, be that buffer between upper management and the guys working on the street. So, yeah, anyway, a little me. I will say that, Jimmy, my main character, is a bourbon drinker, and I'm right there with him.
And you're a bourbon drinker, okay. I know you worked for Operation Alliance, which was the San Diego division of the DEA, and in marine smuggling investigations. And it sounds terrible and exciting and important. Do you miss the excitement? Do you relive your work when you're writing, or...
There's some of that. Operation Alliance is a. I spent 16 years of my almost 23 there, and that's mostly customs agents or now ICE agents. And then there's three or four DEA groups, and then there's a half a dozen local cops and a couple of other. I think we had an ATF agent and we had a couple of Border Patrol guys. You know, and it was family. It was like family to me to a large degree.
Could you explain Operation Alliance?
It was a task force of a bunch of different agencies that was formed to work smuggling cases in San Diego, so narcotic smuggling cases. And they respond both to the ports of entry, to seizures made by Customs and Border Protection, the uniformed guys. Also, they did proactive work. Some of it stemmed from follow-ups to port cases. Some was just developed through informants. Some was tips through other law enforcement contacts, San Diego Police Department's narcotics teams. So we worked a kind of a wide variety of drug cases.
And you were a team. So when you work on the book, you're sort of making that team continue, would you say? Is that it?
Well, I'm trying to let the readers know what it was like to be part of the team.
A window.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about what you said about the influence of family, how difficult it is on family. In your books, the love interest, Margie Gray, she worries about Jimmy Maxwell's safety and about other things. Now, with the safety of law enforcement in the news so much lately, is there anything you'd like to say about that? Was safety a big stressor on you and your family the way it is for your protagonist?
Not nearly as much, probably, as is portrayed in the book. Certainly, you know, we had our moments. I've been involved in search warrants where there were shootings and different things like that. And I was actually moved out of town for a couple of months with a handful of other agents after some threats came in against us. But for the most part, I didn't really spend a whole lot of time even thinking about that. The tougher part of the work is just being on call all the time. And,
right.
and sometimes you head out in the morning and you think you're coming home at 5, but you may not come home for several days.
Really?
You know, because you just don't know where the case is going to take you. But as for safety, local police have a far riskier job than we did as federal agents.
I see.
Because they're dealing with people that they really don't know. They respond to a radio call or pull somebody over for a traffic ticket, and you don't know if it's some guy on the 10 most wanted list or somebody that just hacked his wife up. Whereas normally we knew who we were targeting. So we took the appropriate amount of people with us to deal with that.
Could you tell us briefly one of the little stories in your book? Could you share with the listeners?
Well, one of the funny little stories involved an older lady who was in her late 70s, a white lady, and she came across the border one Friday night, and there was about 28 or 29 pounds of marijuana in the trunk of her car. and so I was interviewing her, and she just said, look, I went down with some friends of mine who live out here in El Cajon, and I had dinner, and I was getting tired, and they just said, take my car and go home. So I gave her a notice to appear. I tended to believe her. She told me who they were and the registration on the car matched. So on Monday morning, I took another agent friend and a El Cajon police detective, and we went and knocked on the door of this couple. The man who opened the door was wearing a pair of leopard skin bikini briefs. His legs were about 3 inches in diameter, you know, and he had a little belly and almost bald, had probably 3 chest hairs. And then he invites us in, And, you know, we tell him why we're there, and his wife comes out, and she sits in front of us and does the Sharon Stone leg cross thing. And so I decide that, you know, I would like to take a look around the house because he's denying everything. Uh-huh. Well, as we are looking around the house, there's a lot of adult-themed things, toys right. and gadgets. Uh-huh. And at one point, I went over to a closet and opened the door. And for about a half a second, I see this body falling out on me. And I actually pulled my gun. It startled me for, you know, it was dark. Uh-huh. But it turned out it was a blow-up doll.
Oh,
and
goodness.
So, of course, my partners were all teasing me that, you know, if I would have shot it, it would have went zipping around the room like a, you know, balloon that got popped or something.
Okay. So you never know if something's going to be dangerous, serious, or a little bit
light. Or a little humorous.
Yeah, a little humorous. One last question, Tim. Tell us what's next in your sequel. I understand that you're writing sequel. When should we expect to see that?
Well, I haven't really decided whether or not I'm going to do another one. I'm leaning heavily towards it.
Uh-huh.
An ongoing investigation kind of ends just before 9/11, so I'm thinking of trying to write a story that will incorporate a little bit of that into it.
Mm-hmm.
But quite honestly, I haven't worked out all the details yet. Both of these other books that I've written took about a year each. If I can get started in the next couple of months, you know, obviously it would be about a year from now before it would come out.
Well, we look forward to seeing it.
Well, I look forward to doing something productive with in my retired years here. So.
And Tim, our time is up, but thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
For more information on Timothy Daniels and his work, please visit his publisher's website at sbpra.com/Timothy Daniels. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson. Today we're on the road in Julian, California, a historic gold rush town in the mountains of East County, San Diego.
Now back in 1870, the town was founded by Drury Bailey and his cousin, Mike Julian. The two cousins were Confederate soldiers during the Civil War, both taken prisoner by the Yankees. After they got out and the war ended, they found their homeland had been laid waste by General Sherman's march to the sea, so they and other family members decided to head west. But Drury missed the boat to Panama, so he went overland instead. He did some hard rock mining in Montana, but then he ran out of money. So he flagged down a wagon train, and by a fortunate stroke of fate, he found that his brother was the driver. Drury founded the town of Julian in 1870 and named it after his cousin, Michael Julian. Traumatized by the war, Drury wanted to help others start new lives. So he gave away plots of land to anyone who agreed to build a home right away, as well as giving plots away for a school, a church, a jail, a town hall, and a chamber of commerce. Now, it wasn't hard to convince people to move to this remote mountain town, since that same year, Julian resident Fred Coleman reportedly paused to give his mule some water and discovered gold in what is now known as Coleman Creek, and the Julian Gold Rush was on.
Today, we've brought along our team of interns to tell you about the hidden treasures in this town of Julian, California, where you can relive the Gold Rush days nearly a century and a half ago.
Hello, this is Trevor Hill, and I'm here with historian David Lewis. Thank you for being here, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So I'm just going to ask you a few questions about Julian. First, I wanted to know, who were the people who founded the town?
Basically, Drury Bailey and Mike Julian were the only people who were really involved in the town. Drury had homesteaded all this land, and then in 1870, when the major hard rock mines were discovered, that's when he hired a surveyor to lay out the town. So that's when I say it started, was February of 1870.
Who was Fred Coleman?
Fred Coleman is a black man that was in the area way before Julian was founded. We have him on the San Diego County tax rolls in 1863, which is kind of interesting. That's when two the major battles of the Civil War took place. So it's right in the middle of the Civil War. So what's Fred doing here at that time period is interesting by itself. We don't have any answers to that. We probably never will. But Fred, he was apparently, according to local lore, had cattle here. He was friendly with the local Indians. We know that because he eventually married an Indian woman, Maria Jesus Anejo. Fred was apparently out looking after his cattle and stopped to water his horse in a creek. Again, this is local lore. They really expand on it sometimes, telling that he took his frying pan out of his saddle bags and all this, but we don't know any of this. We just know that Fred was the guy that discovered the gold. Apparently, Fred couldn't keep a secret, because pretty quick there were a bunch of people panning in that creek. And that was placer gold, the can you do pan for in water in a creek. But it didn't last very long. And so then they started working their way up the creek to find the source of the gold. And that's when they found it in these hills north of town.
And how did the discovery of that gold change Julian?
Well, Julian didn't even exist when that gold was discovered. So that was like the launch point for everything that happened around here. When word got back that they had found successful mine workings up here, and the first loads of ore ended up downtown on display and taken up to San Francisco for milling and assaying, that launched Julian.
Wow. Do you have any colorful stories that you've heard about the gold rush or Julian in general?
There's lots of colorful stories, but I'm the historian for the cemetery too, and people always ask me who the most interesting person from Julian that's buried in that cemetery, and it's Drury Bailey, the man that founded this town. Because when he founded this town, he went and he fought in the Civil War right after he got out of high school. Terrible deal. The family lost all of their land back there, and they end up here. And Drury homesteads all this land, and then, like I say, gets that surveyor. Drury's 26 years old when he did this. I find that pretty amazing because I was still looking for some gas for my car and hoping for a date when I was 26 years old. And this man starts a town. He made a pretty good reputation for himself as being a generous person, but he also had a lot of foresight.
Interesting. Can you tell us about this building that we're in right now, the Pioneer History Museum?
This building started out life. It was built by Joseph Treschel, who was a blacksmith, and he ran it for a few years. This was in the 1890s. And then he sold it, or leased it, I'm not sure which, to Peter Meyerhofer, who brewed beer here. And then it went back to another blacksmith, Christian Grosskopf, who blacksmithed here, and that was the last thing that I know that happened in here. It fell to ruin. All that was left are these rock walls in here. Wow. And in 1952, the Women's Club took it upon themselves to get some county money and some volunteers, and they rebuilt what you see here.
Wow.
So there's been a little expansion out the front, and we're doing a little expansion out the south end right now. But
so these are the original stone walls that we're seeing around
those
this?
Right there, yes. And
wow.
Those were probably mined right here on site. That's Julian Schist, S-C-H-I-S-T, just to clarify that. Anyway, that is what is unique to this Julian area, and it's the quartz within that schist where the gold is found. So when they flattened this area out, they were cutting that stuff off, and it comes off in slabs because it's sedimentary,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard, mm-hmm. and then it's stackable. That's how these walls came about, was right from what was here.
Wow.
How often can you do that anymore?
Do you have any favorite exhibits here at the museum?
Well, probably my favorite is the Bailey exhibit because I almost feel like family. I know as much or probably more than a lot of the family does about them because that's been my focus. It has a few personal things in there, but my favorite one is that pick that's exhibited in there. It's not necessarily a pick that you would use for mining ore. It's for picking out samples. And he was injured in the mine in 1899, disappeared from the logbook for a while on the payroll.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came back, he had fashioned that pick as a cane also.
Wow.
So it's a little short, you might know. And
had a hunch, maybe.
Not Drury. Drury, this is the giant founder of the town, is 5'3" tall. So I've got a little picture that I did once. I photoshopped him in, me and my documentation, right? I photoshopped him in next to me and put a ruler between us just to show the difference of what we look like.
Wow. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
You're very welcome.
Anyone can come here and talk to David on Sundays you're here?
I'm usually here off and on. Lately, I've been able to get Drury's grandson, Richard Bailey. Anybody that comes up here can talk to the grandson of the founder of the town.
I have one more question. When did the mine close, the Julian Mines?
All in varying stages. There was no real just shutdown. People kept piddling around. Mm-hmm. They're still out there piddling around.
Wow, really?
Yeah. You know, especially when times get hard. People are out there trying to get lucky. But, say from 1900, they were pretty much done. But then my grandfather's draft record shows he was a hoist operator at the Golden Chariot, and that would have been about 1918. Now we mine tourists.
Well, okay. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Up next, we're going to have Jaden Jimenez tell us about what he found most interesting about the museum here.
While I was looking through the museum, one of the more interesting things that I found was a railroad spring. It was on a railroad cart. And what they did is they got the spring and put it in the Victorian Town Hall here in Julian. And basically, it was for the dance floor. So when there was large groups of people, they would dance and it would actually really add a springy effect. So I thought that was pretty interesting. One of the only spring floors left is actually in the Hotel del Coronado.
Wow, that's so interesting. Thank you, Dayton.
What do you think, guys? How would you like to go try your hand at some gold mining?
I'm feeling lucky.
All right, let's go.
This is Devon Marshall, and we're here at the Eagle Mine in Julian, which is open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to mid to late afternoon or so if you want to tour the mine or try your hand at panning for gold. Now I'm going to be talking to Mr. Craig Nelson, whose family owns and operates the mines, and with Kim Gordon, one of our guides today.
My grandpa, he ran this from about the late 60s all the way till he passed away. Then my dad took over, and then he passed away about 10 years ago. And then me and my brothers that took over, and we're really blessed to have a grandpa that decided not to dig the gold out of the mountain because that's a lot harder of a job. Taking you folks through that mountain and teaching the history is a lot fun.
So then the real goal is the tourism.
Well, the education.
Okay.
I'll tell you, because the tourists that come to Julian, California, and I always, I'll tell you, the local town museum down there, which is Mr. Lewis,
right,
and those folks, and we just did Kim did a nice seminar down here at the library the other night, and you know, a lot of the kids don't realize what it takes to gold mine back in the 1870s and how they just barely made a living with this type of method. And they all want keyboards and phones and, you know, the technology of today. They don't pick up the pick and shovel and right, you know, do 8, 10, 12-hour shifts under hard rock mining. And that's what we want to show you is it's hard to get a guy to do that kind of work anymore.
So Steven, one of our interns, is here, and he's going to try his hand at some of the panning for gold. Can you come over and give him a couple of pointers on how to do this?
You want the sand to go over the rigid. That's why they make the tools. It's black to keep the metals separated. You can see the colors.
Uh-huh.
So like you said, you scrape to the bottom. And what I do, once you get it in the pan, I settle it, shake it. Because then you get control of the sand by settling the gold to the bottom of the pan. Then when you get to the gold to the bottom of the pan, you simply let the pan and the water do the work for you because that's what it's made to do. But you know what the first gold pan used to be back in 1800? The gold horn. We got a gold horn in there, so what they did is cut the end of the horns off. It's a U shape, right? You scrape it down into the stream, and you rock it back and forth. The gold being heavy stays in the metal. Unfortunately, I'm not going to go cut some horn off of a steer or something like that and get the end of the horn. Take the pan, and then once you settle the gold and you're happy with it, then you just let the water in the pan wash the sand out because the gold is heavier and it goes to the bottom.
Okay, so we have Steven over here who's been trying his hand at it. Steven,
what's his yield?
Come tell us how it's going.
It's been going good. I found myself a lot of good. And the techniques that Kim,
our favorite tour guide, one of our friends and family.
It actually works.
Yeah, ooh, look
now,
at all that.
What you want to do is concentrate. We want to see what you got as a collective. Get it all to the end of the pan, concentrate it by tapping it. Keep water in the pan. And then it separates, just like up at the mill, the sand will always go first, And the gold, being the heaviest, will drag out of the back with the black, that's the iron, separates by the metal like the mill up there. And you tap it and you start rolling it. And the gold being heavier, we're going to chase the gold tail, as they call it. And look at how it comes and drags out the back. So now doesn't that look prettier? The way that you could look at it like that.
Eureka!
Eureka! Your gold strike. So that's what you get. That's about $10, $12 worth of a gold tail right there. Now we're going to start at the Eagle Adit. Because instead of an entrance to the gold mine, they call them adits. A-D-I-T is a crossing puzzle.
What could we expect when we go down to do the mine tour?
Well, what we're going to expect is we're going to go over to the entrance, and we're going to learn how do you know where to start your tunnel? Because they couldn't pan for gold with the streams drying up. So we're going to go over the mountain. We're going to look at the way that the layers and the mountain structured. And we're going to show you how they go into the mountain and abstract the gold-bearing ore, the quartz, out of the mountain. You just learned how to get the gold out of the quartz by the California 5 stand mill. Now remember, that machine would operate right on that foundation right there, and we moved it up there when my grandpa made this a tour business. That way you had two-stage tour area right there, and once you move 22 tons, you don't move it back as you go. So we're going to show you how they go through that mountain and pull out the gold-bearing ore, and you already seen how to process it. So let's go see how we can get that quartz, the gold-bearing ore, out of the mountain.
Okay, we can send our interns down into the mine. You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
We're going to cover.
Bye.
Yeah. Well, it's nice knowing you. We'll see you in about 50 years of being abandoned on the mine.
This is Leon, and we're down in Julian, California, and our interns are back. How did it go on the mine shaft?
Oh, well, it was really great. We got to learn a lot of stuff, and it was really interesting, you know, learning the history. One of the coolest things that I thought that happened while we were in the mine is while we were in, you know, all the lights are on, you can see, you know, decently well, but he took us to this room where there was a candle, and he turned off all the lights, all of the lights to light up the mine, and it was complete darkness. There's no light source coming in whatsoever. And so we lit the candle so we could see how, you know, the old miners used to see just such dim light, and they had to deal with this for 10 hours a day. And so, yeah.
My favorite part of the mine tour was seeing all the gadgets that the miners used back then. And one gadget in particular was the Widowmaker, which was a nomadic drill. It was created to carve deeper into the cave. The nomadic drill would drill into the rocks, and then they would put dynamite in the holes, and the dynamite would explode, causing a lot of dust to affect the lungs of the miners, causing them to have lung cancer. And that's why they call it the Widowmaker.
Well, my favorite part of the tour was we got to this point in the mine where there was a shaft that went straight down for 425 feet, and our tour guide showed us the bucket that they used to pull ore up from the mine, and it turns out that they also used it as an elevator. And there was this huge steam-powered machine that cranked the rope, because it's such a long drop, you can't really have people trusted to hoist someone up that far. And there was a bell on the machine that was so loud, and it was to give signals. Different amounts of rings meant different things. And it was so loud, and it echoed throughout the entire mine, and I just thought it was really cool.
So what do you think? So how would you guys have liked to make your living as a hard rock miner?
I'll leave that to the old-timey miner people.
Tough work, huh? Well, I bet you guys have worked up an appetite.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, walking all over town, going down the mine. All right, well, let's go find something wonderful to eat. And there's no shortage of great places to eat up here in Julian.
Especially if you're looking for apple pie. Because Julian's goal these days is the tourists that come here to enjoy this wonderful town. Let's go eat!
This is Jaden Jimenez with East County Magazine, and I'm here with Charles Scott. He works at Candied Apples and here in Julian, so can you tell us a little bit about history about Candied Apples in Julian?
You bet, yes. My name's Charles. I'm the pastry chef and owner of the Candied Apple Pastry Company in Julian. We've been here for 11 years. Julian's kind of got a very interesting history with apples. It started with the gold miners who settled in this community in the late 1800s. They found that they could grow apples very easy here. In the early 1900s, they sent a bushel of apples to one of the world expos and won a gold medal. And that put Julian on the map for apples. Of course, supply and economics changed the world of apples up here a little bit. As Julian grew, some of the apple farms were turned into housing developments, wineries. And, of course, some of the apple growers retired. but there's still quite a lot of apples being grown up here, from a range of apple cider apples to you-pick apples to organic apples.
And apple pies.
And apple pie. Yeah. Yeah, the apple pie history actually goes back probably to the Farmer family. Bud Farmer was an apple grower up here, and his wife used to make apple pies. This is dating back probably 40 years. As they handed off the business, Liz Smothers from the Julian Pie Company and Anita Knowles from Mom's took that over and kept the apple pie business alive up here in Julian and have kept that name quite alive. Of course, the Julian Pie Company, that works very well. Our little bakery is a European bakery and bistro concept. Of course, being in Julian, you have to make apple pie. So we do make apple pie.
Yeah,
along with many other things like 12 kinds of breads. I have a 7-year-old sourdough starter started in the French way from a white wine yeast. We do pastries, desserts, wedding cakes, catering, full service lunch menu, and of course, French crepes.
Wow. How did you get started with this store?
With this store? Well, this store was a transition from 35 years of hard work. I started in the industry as a young boy doing dishes. Got promoted to cooking because I said I didn't want to do dishes anymore. Worked my way through the industry, some fine hotels. Did my formal training in New York at the International Pastry Arts Center. Ended up in Borrego Springs as the executive chef of a hotel there. And in there at La Casa del Zorro. And in the process of them closing down and selling out, this bakery was on the market, and I chose to buy it 8 years ago.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And it's been 8 years of quite the wild ride of producing delicious desserts, pastries, breads, wedding cakes, birthday cakes.
So can you tell us a little bit about the community here? I know earlier you were talking about how so many people come in.
Julian's, I mean, it's like I said, it's got a very diverse history. Today, Julian has really put itself on the map as a tourist community. Anybody who comes to San Diego is part of the program is to see Julian, hear the history of Julian. I've met people from all parts of the world, the Far East, the Mideast, quite a few European travelers, Sweden, Germany, Italian, and of course America. I mean, I've met people from all over the world who come in the bakery here. It's very fun.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. Thank you for interviewing with us. This was great. We're going to enjoy this delicious lunch. Got a few sandwiches and crepes. A
couple of paninis and some crepes, you bet. Thank you for joining us.
Candied apples, we're looking forward to trying those.
For dessert. There we go. You got to save room for dessert. Life is uncertain. Save room for dessert.
Thank you.
So we'll be back soon with another edition of On the Road in East County. We're signing off from Julian, California.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.